Okay.
Give me a second. I'm obviously going to. In this episode.
Yeah.
I will die.
Okay. If this episode is going out, then it's because I edited it. It's Lydia died. That's why it's not nearly as good as all the rest of them.
I love how you've already like taken ownership of like, you know, oh yeah, no, like I haven't even hit the ground yet. You're already like, you know, I'll take over the editing, I'll do this. Like obviously we'll publish it as a memorial.
We are gathered here today.
That is very dark. What a start. What would you do, Paul, if I die suddenly? Will you continue the podcast?
Well, I would stop the recording.
Oh, thank you. So when the paramedics come in to drag my dead body out.
This much, okay. That would be a viral, you know, we've just started doing video and I got a great idea for a viral clip, which is just like...
Podcast co-host dies on stream.
I mean, it would just be what's his face?
It is so boiling without the fan.
I'm sure. Oh man, I'm gonna open the door because there's no one else here. Normally I have my door closed, but I might try and get. Oh, that's nice. Oh. I opened the door and suddenly there was like this gust of cool air that came through.
Are you downstairs?
No, I'm upstairs.
Like, how does that work? Because, like, our house, like, upstairs is at least 5 degrees warmer than it is downstairs.
So, it's quite, you can kind of see that banister there.
I feel like I'm getting a sneak
peek. You are, a sneak peek into my house.
Sneak preview into your
house. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, that is the hallway, but it's like a mezzanine hallway. So, it's an open,
oh, right.
So when you come in the front door, you can sort of see the wall there. There's no... It goes all the
right.
way up to the ceiling.
Okay, so the cold, but the cold air.
Yeah, it doesn't, but yes, the air circulates quite nicely because it's a big open. It's a big open
right.
space.
Right.
So there's more. I think it's cooler air because in this, there's no air. Like when I have the door closed, there's no air flow, and I've got the windows closed. I've got the curtains closed because I could probably open them actually now because the sun's moved round. But as I said to you earlier, it's like the sun just pours in this way, and bakes this room. So I have to kind of. Call it off, but we'll try. I'll try and open up. But yeah, it's, I think again, it was more just like suddenly the hot air just went out of this room.
We made some very unfortunate choices with our house because the east-facing rooms are both our bedroom and the guest room, which is also doubles down as my office. And then so in the mornings, and also Evgeny's office as well, which is the other room behind me. So all of the three rooms that we would usually be in the morning get blistering hot very quickly in the morning. And then the other side is where our gaming room is, where we spend most of the afternoon / evenings. And then it gets the sun then. So we've really miscalculated how we're going to set up our rooms. But it's due to size, right? It's just like, oh, this size works for this room, this size works for the other room. So we really didn't have a choice there.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, summer in the UK is fun.
It is.
Summer in the UK is very fun. Or as most British people call it, the annual heat wave, which I call summer. Like, oh my goodness, we're having a heat wave again this year at the same time. It's like, yeah, you dinguses, it's called summer.
I guess...
Why do British people refuse to accept that there's summer?
Because we're conditioned to not have summer. We're conditioned that summer is that we are from a very young age. You are taught British summer happens once a year for one day, and then it rains. And so when,
but that's not true.
No, it's not. No, it's
true.
Not true anymore. Yeah, you're right. We act like it's kind of crept up on us, like we should have expected it. When in reality, it's like. It's the summer, so it is hot. And also, I have already had, this morning, all I did was I dropped my kids at daycare, I came home, and I've been for a walk to go and get coffee, and in the time I was in the cafe, for like 20 minutes, I have had the bit hot, isn't it? Nice that summer's finally here. Little bit too hot if you ask me. Oh, I'm looking forward to when it cools down. Do you know how much air conditioners cost these days? That, like, arc of conversation, literally in the people that then came, because I was sat, like, opposite the tilt. And it's people, I was just like, yeah, it's hot. And I accept that there is a point, and I get this completely, that there is a point where it is too hot to like be productive and work. This temperature's great where I'm sat by the pool.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, yeah. Like, I want to be near a lake right now and just take in the sunshine. But no, I'm in the house where it is 20, 25, 26 degrees at the moment in this room, and I am dying.
This is also the episode where we're like, yeah, let's start recording video. Which means we have to be reasonably dressed as well.
Yes.
How else can that be?
Well, speak for yourself, mate.
Well, I mean, yeah, like, business on top.
pool party at the bottom. I'm worried that if throughout this recording, my muscles are going to seize up because I got back into kickboxing.
Oh, okay.
By the way, yesterday, I used to do kickboxing quite seriously, like sort of 2-3 years ago. I have forgotten how nice it feels and how amazing I feel doing it. So I'll get back into it. But yesterday was my first workout in that many years with kickboxing. Yeah. And I went full on because like, oh, this is fun again, right? Like, and I just went on for a full hour nonstop. I have bruises on my shins because I was kicking the bag so hard. Yesterday when I got home, my pinky, as it started typing on the PC, my pinky started shaking from the exhaustion of my hands of being inside the gloves. And this was yesterday. And as you know, usually muscle fatigue comes in about the day two. Today, I still feel great.
Yeah. Tomorrow
I won't be able to get out of bed. Tomorrow I'll be bedbound.
I had the same thing, like, was it maybe, no, like 2 weeks ago? Anyone who trains in the gym knows that there's a cliche about skipping leg day. Again, as I suggest, when you like you train different parts of your body on different days, if that's what you do, and training legs, it's the closest I feel to being a masochist because I both love and hate training legs. Upside of training legs, you get to lift lots of heavy things and feel very strong because you are doing deadlifts and you're doing squats and it feels like a workout in the moment. Downside of leg day, you cannot walk for 2 days after because you just destroy. And I was that, and I was, again, I hadn't trained legs properly in a few months. And I'm like, right, again, I'm taking the running again more seriously. I'm training for the race in October. I need to start training my legs. And I was like, yeah, great. I feel great. Deadlift PP, squats feeling good. Because I've had like knee issues as well. And then, yeah, like even the next day I was like, I can't walk. This is really painful. And it lasted for like 2.5 days. But again, I was kind of, I have that weird thing of going, I hate that this feels really painful, but also I kind of like that this hurts.
It's a good pain.
It's a good pain. But it is not how I feel when I train anywhere else. If, like, I train any other part and then that aches, I'm like, no, my shoulders just hurt.
Yep.
I think leg pain is the only thing that feels, in any way, gratifying.
I completely agree with you, but I also love leg day. I think it's a stereotype that women tend to be a lot, like, we favor leg days and we favor just using our legs more when it comes to, like, weightlifting and things like that. I love me a leg day. Put me in the upper body day. Oh God, I hate every second of it. I like me a bit bicep curl, I love a good bicep curl. That you know, that feels good as well. But anything, like especially like anything over my shoulders.
Oh yeah, no.
Upper
body bench. Bench is good. Good classic bench.
Oh yeah.
A curl.
Yeah,
that curl is good.
Yeah.
I don't mind like a, you know, like an over the head like that. But when you start going up, no.
Like, I have a question for you, because like, you've also been traveling recently, and I have a summer of travel, which I tend to, for some reason, I say this to myself every year, summer is not going to be as bad as last summer. Like, I'm not going to travel as much as I have last summer. And then suddenly, without expecting it, it happens that I then travel for 4 years in a row, like 4 years, 4 weeks, it feels like 4 years in a row, 4 weeks in a row. Mostly in Europe, which is great because, you know, short flights and everything, but it's still moving away and being outside of the house and having to pack and having to do everything. And also, any habit that I'm trying to set up, be it, like in my case at the moment, like I'm focusing on learning Danish, which is like, it has to be like a regular daily thing, or getting back into kickboxing and like, you know, getting back into a physique that I will be happy to start grading for a belt again, which is what I really love to do because it's so much fun. How do you keep up? Because you've sent me like a cheeky message of like, you know, ooh, I'm continuing to work out whilst I'm traveling. And I'm like, how? How do you do that?
So I kind of, if I have the option to look at where I'm staying. So if I'm traveling, I think traveling, it depends. I would say traveling for work, I will always look and see, does the hotel have a gym? Or is there a hotel I can stay at that has a gym? And I was quite fortunate last week. It had a really nice one. And it had that facility there. And if it doesn't have a gym, then one of my options to get in some form of exercise. So when I travelled a couple of months ago, right, there wasn't a gym there, but I was staying in a city. Okay, so I could go for a run. And I think the first thing is like literally just being prepared. So I would take my running shoes, I would take my kit. So having that intention to do it. And also just get up and go.
Do you think you find it easy to do that because you already have the habit set up ahead of time? Like, for example, with the running,
yeah,
right? Because I know you regularly,
yeah,
run. So is it when you go travel, it's just I'm continuing what I'm already used to doing?
Yes, I think it is. And I think it's I would rather do... So running, if I'm traveling for a week, if I only get in one run, that's better than nothing. But doing, like... I adjust my expectations of what I can achieve, but I also go, I just have that intent to do it. So I go, I will get up half an hour earlier so I can go for a run or go for the workout. And I will be honest, this is a recent development for me because...
Oh, okay. So you two were traveling like, before we traveled.
Oh, horrendously. So I would say, honestly, like pre-COVID... I was awful. When I was traveling at my most, I had all the bad habits. Eating, the drinking, the late nights, because when you're traveling on your own and there's nothing to do, what else do you do? All of that stuff. So some of it is also driven by a desire to sustain and improve on the level of physical health that I've got to now. When it comes to exercise... and travel.
So what you're saying is I shouldn't feel bad that I'm trying to set up a new habit whilst I'm traveling.
No, because...
because that's what I'm trying to do, right? Because it was unfortunate that just due to, you know, a couple of health problems and everything, like I wasn't able to get into a good habit of like keeping physically fit sort of in the last couple of months. And then the last couple of months have been just travel nonstop. And I'm sitting here going like, come on, like you need to, you know, just do it, uh-huh, right? Like, as Adidas keeps on telling me, just do it. But I really struggle because every single time I get into a nice habit or a nice routine of actually doing things that are good for me, you know, both physical health and mental health. And then I just, you know, and then I go off to another trip and it's like, well, that's gone now.
I get that. And I've had that. But something I learned from an old PT was... His thing was like, people always say, oh, I'm going to start this like next month. So I could say, oh, it's end of June, but I'm going to really start like getting in shape in July. And he's like, if you have that mentality, you will always
it's
do
always
that.
Gonna
yeah,
pushed.
Always going to get pushed. The other thing he taught me that has really stuck with me, particularly around, again, like nutrition and stuff, is he's like, if you have an off day or an off week, that's not going to undo everything that you've done up until that point. And that's happened. So just get back on it. Like when you get back home, just carry on. Just, I mean, so we talk, I think, you know, I've spoken to you before about the diary that I do every day. I'm awful for doing that when I'm traveling, but I get home and just catch up with it and then go, right, let's just build that. Because it's just one of those things where I just don't always remember to do it.
No, especially when you change environment, when you have so many things. Because especially if you're, even if you're traveling, like for work, I found it easier when I'm traveling for work to keep with my habits because
yes.
I felt like I was a lot more strict with myself. It's because you didn't choose to do this. This is not a vacation. This is a work day outside of your home or your office. So you need to be as strict or as structured as you would be normally in your work day. So you're saying I shouldn't feel bad?
No, you shouldn't feel bad.
To keep habits over summer of travel.
No.
I'm trying to, by the way. Like to be completely, you know, realistic here. I'm conscious that is a fact of life. Like I cannot expect of myself to be really good with diet, to be really good with this as I am traveling every other week. Because at the very least, it's exhausting to the nth degree to be constantly conscious and thinking of this. But I do try my best to do like little things as I'm traveling, mm-hmm. right? Like again, they, you know, oh, what is like, I'm trying, for example, the easiest thing for me is to keep a constant breakfast, uh-huh. right? Like I love me some oats for breakfast, like whatever format that is. To me, that is the perfect, like, okay, this is a good habit to sort of hook into everything. I'm trying right now, and that's the next thing I'm going to try to do is sort of like, as breakfast is happening, to hook in the Danish learning at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
I might do it like over as I'm eating breakfast, I might do my language studies. Then, you know, one exercise thing a day. It doesn't yeah. have to be a workout. It doesn't have to be like specifically kickboxing or anything like that. It could be we're in a new location or an mm-hmm. old location that I just enjoy being in. Like, let's go for a bike ride. Let's mm-hmm. go for a walk. Let's mm-hmm. go for, you know, I'm trying to get back into running again, but it's really hard at the moment.
Yeah.
Because just, I genuinely don't enjoy running all that much. I know it's good for me, but it's like walking and bike riding, I would prefer those versus running. Yeah. But I'm really trying, as the next couple of weeks are also coming in, it's just like, okay, 2 weeks of traveling abroad, 2 weeks of then traveling in the UK, and only then will I be okay and mm-hmm. be at home, and then I'll be able to sort of get back into like a weightlifting routine and everything, you know, alongside with the kickboxing. So I'm really thankful that we're having this conversation right now, because like, okay, to me, you, Paul, are an example of someone that really has their, like, you know, you know what you're doing when it comes to like your physical health. I know that has come from like a long time of you working on it, yeah. but I look up to you a lot when it comes to this sort of stuff. It's like, okay, if Paul can do it, and I know how busy you are, I know like where your brain is at most of the time, because like we talk about things so much. It's like, if you can do it and you have found the pattern that works for your brain, I'm sure I will find the pattern that works for mine. It won't be what it was like 2-3 years ago. Like, because like, I was my fittest during the pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
But that was because the world wasn't working.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because I had no other things to do other than just, I was walking for like 6 hours mm-hmm. a day. Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. Because I could do a lot of my training, a lot of like the calls I was doing on the phone, and I could just do that. That cannot happen right now. That's just not a thing I can do. Right? Which is fine. It's absolutely fine. The world has woken up. I much prefer the world this way. But that means I need to figure out a more sustainable adult-like way of keeping myself fit and healthy. Mm-hmm. And also like, you know, funny thing, living with other people, your diet is also a lot harder to sort of mm-hmm. be very strict about it, because like there's a box of ice cream in the freezer, which I didn't used to have when I was living by myself. Mm-hmm. But hey, guess what? It exists now. And that's fine. Like, it's fine to have ice cream from time, especially when it's, you know, ridiculous weather.
Yeah. And again, like you, memories are like, hey, look at how fit you were 3 years ago. And I'm like, yeah, thanks for that. I appreciate,
yeah,
you know, when I, you know, yeah, okay. I know that it's like 3 years ago when I was walking 17,000-18,000 steps a day, and I could still like eat pretty much like I do now. But I had, you know, it's like, hey, look, you were really trim. And now look, but I go, well, yeah, but to your point, that was a moment in time. And I much prefer the world this way too. And I think just being able to maintain a healthy relationship with the habit is as important as the habit itself. Have you read Atomic Habits?
I have.
Yeah.
I have.
But that's his thing, isn't it? Is he's like, if you miss a day, okay, like don't beat yourself up about it. Just move to the next day. And like that's one of those, it's one of the few cliche, I call it like the LinkedIn, there's sort of the LinkedIn sort of cliche books to read. Atomic Habits being one of the kind of originals. But I actually think on the whole, it's a pretty good read. And there's not much in it that I have problems with. I think if you take it that, as you say, you have to adjust the habits to your environment. But that's it. And again, on the funny thing on the nutrition side, right? You said you've got a good routine around breakfast. I was at the point where I was tracking every single thing I ate through the day. But that's not sustainable. But what it did do is it taught me, oh, okay, it does ingrain that I know that if I buy this brand of yogurt and I have half a pot with some oats and some fruit, then I'm going to get a good amount of protein in, I'm going to get some fruit in, and it's going to fill me up. It's just looking at those kind of, looking at things sort of holistically. And again, like the Danish learning, if you're just trying to do it, and it's funnily enough, actually, I was speaking to my team about this earlier, because they're doing stuff with LinkedIn learning, and they were like, oh, you know, I'm trying to get onto it, but I don't have time. And I said, right, aim to do an hour a week. And you can do that in 1 hour that you do over lunchtime. You can do that in 2 half-an-hour chunks. You can do it in 4 15-minute chunks. But look at what you're trying to achieve. Break it down into a way that's realistic and then go after that. And don't beat yourself up, you know, if you don't hit it. My main fitness goal at the moment, I want to average 12,000 steps a day over a week, because that's the thing that I know is the most consistent. It's the thing that's most consistent to do. It's achievable and it fits around my lifestyle,
yep.
Which is very different to what it was 3 years ago.
Yep.
There's a lot more going on now.
Tell me about it.
Yeah. And final thing I'll say, if you're traveling for pleasure, just enjoy it.
Calories don't count on travel.
No, they don't.
No, they absolutely do.
they do, but one or two, yeah, again, I think it's worth distinguishing between, like, if you're traveling regularly for work or you're traveling for, like, a prolonged period, and I wouldn't even say 4 weeks is that prolonged a period. I mean, like, 3 months. If you're traveling regularly, 6 months, that's when you want to probably be more like making sure that you're building up travel habits. But like, if you have like a couple of weeks at an all-inclusive, you're not gonna blow out your everything. And again, I don't want to turn this into like a white man talks about nutrition on a podcast, because that's an area we do not want to go down and is well covered. But in short, just focus. Just do what's achievable. And don't beat yourself up.
Minimum viable habits.
Exactly.
That's something I'm gonna have to figure out for myself for the next couple of weeks.
Yeah.
And I'll report back and tell you how that actually worked out.
What's your top three things? What are the three things of all the things you're trying to do? And this is like, I am terrible at this. I am really, really bad at, like, not going this and this and this and this and this. But
right.
I shared this with you yesterday, a course that I'm working to at the moment. There was just a line in it, which was, if you have more than three priorities, you're not prioritising. And after I'd gotten up off the floor from being personally attacked by this man on the screen, I was like, it's true. It makes sense.
That's a really good question. What are my top three things at the moment?
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be working towards being a healthier me.
Mm-hmm.
That's definitely going to be the first thing. So again, and that means many, many different little things. And if I have to pinpoint one thing, it is to get movement in every day.
Mm-hmm.
So
yep.
One thing. If I do one thing today, mm-hmm. that's going to be that. And I do mean it like in a workout. Like walking is one thing, but I do want to have a workout a day. Whatever it is,
mm-hmm.
Then it's going to be language learning, because it's incredibly good. That's my physical workout and my mental workout.
Yep.
So because there's something very magical about learning a language, especially as intensely as I am right now,
mm-hmm.
which really primes your brain for everything else.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third one is not losing track of what's important for the business.
Mm-hmm.
So that is focusing on the highest available things that I can do today, one step at a time. Don't get lost. Don't get overwhelmed. Don't get like, you know, drafted into the little teeny tiny details of like, ooh, you know, I need to spend today to like make like the perfect little logo and I'm going to spend the next week doing that. No, it's like, what is the most valuable thing you can do today for the business? So I would say those are the three things, like physical health, mental health, business health.
Yeah.
I should rename my yearly theme to health, to be honest with you. And I might. Because like, if you remember, like that is something that I do throughout the year. And I feel like because of the many things that had happened in the last sort of like four to 6 months, I have shifted away a little bit from that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's really important for me to use the sort of like half year points, because we are, by the way, happy half a year of doing this podcast. It
Yay.
Has been half a year.
We did it. Yeah, hey, we're still going.
We're still going, and we still have things to talk about, which is great. Hopefully that never runs out. But to me, that's something that I really need to, and most likely I will do so, you know, as now as we're going to be traveling for the next week, because I find the travel is a really good time for me to think through stuff. So I'm really going to reconsider like what is it the things I'm going to be focusing for the next 6 months, because I still think a year is quite a lot. And the beauty of a theme versus goals is that, you know, I haven't failed my theme previously, because just the theme I needed at the beginning of the year is not the theme I need now. Now is something else completely. And I think, you know, half half year of health actually has a really good ring to it. And I think I'm going to stick to that. And it's going to be those three healths. It's going, again, physical, mental, business health. I do have something, you know, the big topic for today that I want us to cover off is actually something that came from our prep for an engagement and a training that I'll be doing in the next couple of weeks, which is, I think, a really important question. And I've been mulling it over for now so many years, which is, it's a very navel-gazy, very, you know, wishy-washy feeling. But I think it's a really important one. It's a really, arguably, a very soft topic for our careers and like the roles that we enjoy being in. But really, what is the purpose of pre-sales is what I'm going for. And I think it's both a very practical question of like, what is the role of pre-sales within the organization? But it's also like a deeper, more human question, which is like, what is our purpose within those roles as us humans that are doing this role? When I ask you that, Paul, mm-hmm. and I just ask you like, you know, oh, what is our purpose? What is the first thing that comes to your mind as a pre-sales person? Not as a human, not as a dad.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
But like, you're working in pre-sales, Paul. What is your purpose?
Funnily enough, when you first pitched this to me, I actually can tell you what my first kind of thing my head went was, I can tell you what it's not.
What is not? Well, that's a good way to respond to it. So what is not our purpose?
It's not to secure the technical win.
Ooh. Bold. I love it. Go on. Why?
Because that's too reductive. It reduces our purpose to a single thing. A single task, a single goal. Now, historically, the technical win was sort of talked about as being the lofty goal of being in pre-sales. The sales engineer, oh, they come in, they secure the technical win and the salesperson secures the business win. But the reason why I say that I do not think that the role of a solutions engineer is to secure the technical win is because that negates everything else that we're there to do. I would say you can divide up the, I guess, specifics of who does what in this, but I really like the analogy of talking about this as a co-pilot. You have two people in the cockpit. You have a shared and equal responsibility for bringing the plane into land safely, but you both have quite distinct functions in that. And if you're functioning as a co-pilot, and this is the downside of having my window open, is you can now hear the aircraft going
I think
over.
It's very thematic. Like, we're talking about aircraft,
it is.
And there you go.
If you think about, and I read, and someone told me this quite recently, this idea of landing a deal is bringing a plane into land. And there are so many aspects of it. That's like, yes, that is so crucial, because when you think about it, there's actually, you're having to communicate a lot of people in that process. You're having to do a lot of things at once. You're having to think about, where are you going? What's in front of you? What's behind you? What's to the left of you? What's to the right of you? And the role of a pilot and co-pilot, the pilot is ultimately accountable or is leading that flight. Their role is to instruct the co-pilot as to what they need to do. And I don't think that it's a downside to say in a engagement to say that the account executive needs to be directing the solution engineer as to what they need to do. Because that's not telling, that's not saying, I want you to do this. It's saying, I need you to help me with this thing. And I know that you're the person who has the expertise and the skill set to do that. But that's what I would say. So what's the purpose in pre-sales? It's to help bring the plane to land. That's what
I also want to highlight something for folks that are not that familiar with the aviation industry, that a co-pilot doesn't mean a lesser pilot. Because in this analogy, we are saying pre-sales is the co-pilot. That does not mean they're subservient. That does not mean that they are less adequate at their jobs. That does not mean that it's a different set of skills required than the pilot. And a lot of folks in the aviation industry, they are co-pilots their whole lives because that is where their core skill set actually lies versus being a pilot. So I just wanted to highlight that because I think it's a very important distinction there.
Agreed.
Where, again, not subservient, not lesser in any way, shape, or form, a different skill set, and required for that. And I think actually, and I'm not quite sure because I've been out of touch with the aviation industry for a couple of years now, but there was a push to sort of change the way they even introduced themselves as, you know, their title was still both are pilots, but for them to introduce themselves as co-pilots versus one being the pilot and the other wing being the co-pilot. But in this analogy, it makes sense, you know, where you have the person that's actually leading the charge or leading the initiative of, in this case, again, the analogy of the landing, but mm-hmm, in reality, mm-hmm. both are as necessary to each other as the other. And I quite Absolutely. Like that analogy. Yeah. I really resonate with that. There is something quite visual in imagining that, and sort of like a level of responsibility that I think, yeah. unfortunately, a lot of pre-sales folks are missing because of this obfuscation of the technical win. It's like, all you have to do is just go in and have the technical win. That is a very, again, I think it's, obfuscation is really the key word there that I keep on circling back around, because it sort of hides to the pre-sales person a lot of the elements that they are not focusing on that I truly believe they should be. And it comes a lot into, like, you know, we usually talk about, like, you know, how are pre-sales people being rewarded for their engagement in different ways. I think it's particularly hard for folks that are not tightly aligned to a particular patch mm-hmm. or mm-hmm. a number. So I wasn't like that. So as an individual contributor, I was tied directly to a number, which I shared with my account executive, where the only difference is there was, you know, the base pay versus compensation. So obviously, like, the ratios there were different, but we were still tied, our success was tied to a specific number. I think it's a lot harder for folks that don't have that to sort of imagine themselves as responsible for a particular number when it's a team number, when it's a company-wide bonus. And I think that's where a huge amount of obfuscation happens and mm-hmm. a huge amount of, like, oh, I'm just here to do a demo starts kicking in. But I think yeah. there is a place where you can still imagine yourself as an on-call pilot that you're brought mm-hmm. in last minute, right, into a flight. You are still, regardless of how you usually operate, regardless if this is something that you are constantly responsible for, mm-hmm. you are responsible and co-owning that one situation from yeah. the moment you get engaged in it. Again, even if you don't usually cover, even if this is not your account manager, even if this is, like, you know, you don't get paid directly for this one deal, mm-hmm. there still has to be something in your head that prompts you to think, this is something that I am co-responsible for. It could, and again, I know it's incredibly hard, especially when it's like the one conversation that you're being yeah. brought in, but yeah. that one conversation is still, you know, visualizing, imagining you are still, that's just the land, like, again, mm-hmm. you're just being brought in to do the landing, right? Someone else did the takeoff. Someone else is doing the cruising speed. Someone else is doing everything else. You're being brought in to do the landing. You're yep. still highly, highly responsible for that part.
I'll take another analogy, right, which is pretty much any sports team. And I actually quite like, and the kind of cliche that always comes back is, you know, back to, like, oh, the account exec is quarterbacking the team, right, in an American football sense, but...
You've lost with American football.
Right. Essentially, you are... The way I talk about it is I go, the team captain. Right. If you have a team, whether you're playing basketball, football, rugby,
okay.
whatever, pick your sport, you have a team game, you have a captain, and that doesn't, as you say, degrade the function of anyone else on that team, but somebody has to lead the role. And I'll take a rugby example, rugby union. You could position the SC, right? Arguably, maybe you're the fly half, right? Which is your analogy of you're getting brought in to do something. The fly half in rugby is the person who typically, when you see someone lining up to kick the ball, to take a penalty, that's the fly half's role. They are not always the person who is up front, scoring the tries, really pushing through, but they're an absolutely critical part of the team. And whilst they may be not scoring, like, they're not always the captain, they can be the captain, they're not always scoring the big points, they're still scoring key number points, they can still make a change to the game. But even if you're someone at the back, even if you're on the wing, whatever position you're playing, again, in football, if you're the goalkeeper, you're not going to score any goals, but you're going to save some. You're still a critical part of that team. And I think what I like about actually that analogy is then you're also acknowledging all the other roles that play in to this. If you're talking about just about the relationship, as I say, between account executive and SE, yeah, pilot, co-pilot, but then arguably you have all the rest of the crew on the plane.
Yeah, you have all the rest of the crew. You have your air traffic control.
You have all the people on the ground, right? It's this operationally. It's never just like one or two people who are responsible for it.
No. But that analogy is, I think, is very like leaning into that like ASE relationship. But I think you absolutely hit the nail on the head there, where it's not just that; it's also a conglomerate of roles and personalities within those roles that make sure that at the end of the day we get to, you know, the deal gets done. But I think it's especially important if we hone in and focus in on the pre-sales, you know, if we are talking to pre-sales people, is to understand their own importance and their own purpose, which, again, I don't want to undermine or sort of push away, you know, but this feels like a topic for another time. What I really want to hone in today is exactly, you know, what is the pre-sales person doing, why they should feel a lot more joy and personal engagement with what they do. Because I genuinely think, Paul, that pre-sales is really one of the coolest, you know, careers you can have in tech.
Mm-hmm.
Whilst
mm-hmm.
again, product management and, there's a lot of roles within a tech company that are also incredibly interesting and cool. But I think there's something very unique and very special. And I can be incredibly biased on this. But I think there's something incredibly special about this role because it's such a combination of so many different elements of personalities and skills and responsibilities that is quite unique. And that's why I think it's also like it's the age-old struggle of what are we called. It comes from that. It's because it's such a mixture of everything else all put together. And also it gives you incredible freedom as an individual to come into this role and make it your own. But I think the key to do that is to take that responsibility and understand what is your purpose, why are you here, and what is the value that you can bring to the team, to the, you know, corporation that you're working for the company, for your leadership. Whatever that is, you really need to hone in on what is my purpose.
Yeah, I think in that, and I agree, this is a topic that you can go, but I guess it's helpful to contextualize it. What is, if you kind of want to just take it at it, I guess it's like a purest essence of what is it to be an SE. You are there to aid people in making the right decision. You know, because you're often, and we forget this, right? I think we forget the role that we're playing often in this discussion, which is, we're very much like, we come in and we see our role as very functional, but actually it's a lot more nuanced because, yeah, you might be coming in to like just do that one demo, but actually it's that missing piece that in your customer's mind that fit, and they go, this is the missing thing. This was the thing that I needed to answer in my mind to get everything to click. And so I think you're there to, and I agree entirely, by the way. Again, I'm probably biased. I think this is the best role in tech that there is, with the caveat that for the right person, and again, something which maybe gets a little bit lost sometimes, I think, in the discussion around this, and I think this does relate to what the purpose is, right, is that we talk about it's the best job in the world for the right kind of person, for the right combination of interests, of skills, of engagement. It's that kind of thing. It's that combination. But the purpose there is, as I say, it's to serve as that person who has the... I'm trying to avoid using the sort of terminology that has been used in the past. Things like trusted advisor, because I don't feel like that has as much value now, because it's just been repeated so often, and it's been like, oh, trust me. But the what is it? I put it another way. What was it when I was an IC still, and even now today? What is it that gets me up in the morning excited to go and do my job? It's that aha moment. It's that moment when somebody sees something and it clicks, and they go, oh, I get it. Right, this is how this is going to help me.
So, do you think then? Because we could say, like, pre-sales is the best job for the right person. Do you think that is the requirement for pre-sales? for you to find joy as an individual contributor, by the way, because individual contributors in the leadership, I think it's two different things, and we'll talk about that in a bit. But for an individual contributor, is that the thing that you should be looking at yourself to say, is that the thing that brings me joy, is to get that? Because I completely, like, you've taken the words right out of my mouth. That was the point about, like, I think I remember it very clearly. Well, it was about 7 to 8 months into my individual contributor role as a field SC that I first got that aha moment from a customer. And gosh, was it gratifying. It was suddenly, it's like, I want to do this every single day from this point on, because seeing that the light bulb moment, like in their eyes, with them, you know, it clicked, they got it, they're on, like, we are now on the same wavelength as I'm talking. That was it. But I think that the more I talk, the more I feel like maybe that is really the hard requirement for individual contributors. What do you think?
I'd agree. I think you have to have a desire to help other people, which might sound counterintuitive when you're talking about a quote-unquote sales role, but I think you do. I think you have to have that desire to want to help other people, because that is where you will be guided to help them make the right decisions for them. And I think you have to combine that with the right level of competitiveness. Mm. You've got to have that. It's that mix. It's that mix of altruism with competitive drive, with creativity, clearly technical skill. But if
I pick on the competitive part a little bit, because I don't think I'm particularly competitive, and I'll tell you why I don't think that is such of a hard requirement in the case that you believe in your product. Because that was one thing that I, looking back at it now, I truly believed in the product that I was selling, and it was one of the reasons I actually even joined VMware at the time. It's because, like, this product set, not everything else they're selling, this specific product set that you want me to sell, I really believe it's the best of its kind in its category. Truly, no questions asked. Did I think our competitors had their own place in the world? Absolutely. And a lot of my conversations was about, oh, you guys have, you know, vendor B? Fantastic. Keep them. They do a really good job at these functions. This is where we fit best. So I never really competed in the traditional sense of, like, oh, you know, hitting on my chest and saying, like, oh, we're the best, you have to use us instead of other people. And I think that's part of the reason why I was so successful as a pre-sales person. It was because I could acknowledge and could see the benefits of other products in the space, and it didn't feel the need to be competitive and to put myself out there and go, like, no, we're the best, you know, I'll do it first, I'll do it better. It's like, no, there's a fit for everyone. That might be a unique scenario that I'm talking to, but I think the more I learn about what other people sell, about other products in the space, this competitiveness comes in from the traditional features perspective, like, you know, oh, our features are better than yours. But especially, like, nowadays, especially in the SaaS space, everyone does the same stuff, right? You see your competitors doing, you know, a feature and a function, you're going to implement it as well, because obviously people are wanting it. Mm-hmm. So from that point on, it's no longer a competition. It's how do this fit in the specific customer or the specific prospect that you're talking to? So that's the only thing, is, as you were talking, I'm like, is competitiveness really a key there? Sorry, didn't mean to challenge you or anything. It immediately kicked in, because I've heard it before as well. But I never really resonated with that part, because my personality is not competitive.
Yes. Well, okay. But I think you...
I put you on the spot there, didn't I?
No. So I think that you are probably more competitive than you think you are, just in your nature. So you've told me that you do kickboxing. Yeah. And there is an element of doing any kind of sport, any kind of, like, contact thing where you're not investing everything in winning, but there's a competitive edge to it, and I think you get enjoyment because what you're doing is you're competing against somebody else in that context. When I say that, I would think you do, even if you're going into a situation where, you're, as you say, and you're right about other vendors, but I think that is being able to know, okay, what is it that they do really well, and where should we be trying to differentiate, and what is the value that we're going to bring over them? And I think that, I suppose, again, if I put it another way, when you saw an opportunity that you were working on closed, one, that must have felt good.
Indeed.
That's what I mean by that.
Because it means I landed the plane correctly, right?
That's it. But that's,
like,
and that's what I'm saying by that.
We managed to not, you know, hit the ocean.
Right. But I do think that's also the competitive. I think there's a healthy competition.
Right.
And that's, I guess differentiating it from what you're saying is that what I don't mean is a winning against all odds. I will be, take what I will say, whatever it is. And that's maybe the.
I will crush the competition, right? Like, we will be.
Right.
Like, there isn't anything like that.
No. And I actually think it's interesting that in the SaaS space, there seems to be more of a healthy kind of relationship between competitors. And I think that, you know, you shouldn't feel like, if you're speaking of an IC, you shouldn't feel like you can't engage with someone like your competition. Mm-hmm. Like, you don't have to talk about your product, right? But they're your competition, but actually it's that competitiveness that is what's going to push you to do better than you're doing right now. Because if there was no, when you're going into a presentation, the thing that's driving you to want to do really well is you're like, I want to do really well because I want people to think that I'm great. And that's a competitive mindset. Less so really go crush the competition. But again, I think the sports analogy works, right? Because you're going up against people who are doing the same thing as you, probably also doing it very well. But that is what's pushing you to, I think you have to have a certain amount of drive from what you want to be driven by success. I think if you're just driven by purely by just delivering stuff, pre-sales is not the role that I would put you in. Because if, take an example, if what you get joy from in work is seeing the fruits of what you've worked on being used out in the real world, that's like services, that's delivering stuff. Pre-sales doesn't, you don't really deliver anything tangible, but what you do is you do help, you get people to that aha moment, and you also get people to see a difference that it's going to make in their lives and going to make to their day-to-day.
You are a pre-sales leader, Paul.
I am a pre-sales leader.
You are. How many? How long? It feels like you've been a pre-sales leader since I've known you, but that's not true, is it?
How long
has it been?
6 months.
6 months.
Since the start of 2020. Well, this time around, I was a people manager for around 6 months in 2021, and then I went back to being an IC, and that's a story for another time. And then I was a senior SE, and then I came and became a principal SE, which I see as a leadership role. And for anyone that hasn't ever looked into the differences between leadership and management, I would encourage you to do so. But in short, I would say I have been a pre-sales leader, or in a leadership pre-sales role, for just over 2 years. I have been a people leader for 6 months. And I think that's a really key thing just to kind of differentiate, because, and again, without going into like a load of detail about the differences with what defines a leader, how do you be a leader and have a team? As I say, topic for another time, and lots of good stuff out there. But yeah, I've been a people leader with my current team for 6 months. And it both feels like I've been in this position for much longer, but it also feels like I started it yesterday.
Why do you think that is the case?
Something actually, and I right at the start of my time in this role, I was actually sharing quite a lot about this. I think it's because, just like being a new, or being an SE in general, particularly when you're new, there is so much to learn all the time, and things are constantly changing all the time, that you feel like you've been through, and I feel like I've been through, 7 or 8 different iterations of what this role actually is, and what my role is as a people leader and a pre-sales leader. But at the same time, so that's kind of where the, like, I suppose the length of time comes in. But also because of that same reason, it's why it feels like I've only been doing it for a few weeks. Because I've only been doing pre-sales leadership in this way for 2-3 weeks. And that's not that I've had like a Damascene conversion to a new way of operating. But I've constantly been, again, back to the fly man sheet. I'm constantly kind of adjusting my position. Like, I'm keeping steady, but... Or if you're driving a car, you never just take your hands off the wheel and just let the car just drive, because it will immediately get pulled off to a different direction, even if it says it's full self-driving. But you're always having to kind of course correct, and you're always having to, because you've got that information kind of coming at you constantly. But you're always having to adjust to kind of what's in front of you, think about what's just gone behind you, and also be in the moment that you are right now.
There are some days that I think that maybe I shouldn't have jumped ship as quickly to have my own business and to actually have experienced being in a leadership position. I think there's a lot of value in there, but then also at the same time, you know, having your own business is technically you're both the individual contributor and the leader at the same time, and this and that and everything at the same time. Mm-hmm. So maybe I'm not missing all that much. But I'm always very keen on listening to your challenges when it comes to, not challenges, but also, like, you know, the problems that you're trying to solve, and, you know, how do you think through the different tasks and aspects that you need to do as a leader, especially like in a relatively, you know, medium to large organization that you are currently in. What do you think about individual contributing SEs, which this is your path?
Mm-hmm.
What about people who are currently individual contributors and want to get into leadership roles or have found themselves in leadership roles, maybe as a promotional path or anything, which, again, topic for another time, like, you know, is it wise to promote people from individual contributors to leadership as a form of promotion? Maybe not, maybe yes. How to solve that? Again, much bigger topic. But what I really want to hone in on today is... Well, we were talking about what is the purpose of the pre-sales individual contributor, which is what we focused in, like, until now. What would you say, and this may be a very existential question to you at the moment, what is your purpose then as a leader, and how and where do you find that aha moment? Because, you know, logically, you're not spending as much time anymore, or if any, in front of customers, in front of prospects. So what is then now the aha moment or the moment of joy that you found before? Now as a leader, what has that transformed into?
So I would say my overriding purpose as a leader is to lead and enable my team to get where they need to be.
What does that actually mean?
It means a variety of things. So let's come back to the sports team analogy, because I think that's easy. If you think about the role of a coach, they're not playing on the pitch. They are in the game, they're on the sidelines. They're kind of, by that point, there's not a huge amount they can do to influence. They can change people out, but all the work kind of happens leading up to that point. So it's about setting people up. I would always, the other way I put it is setting people up for success. So that can be directly coaching individuals. It can be making sure that there are processes in play, that expectations are clear across the organization of what is the function of the pre-sales team, how do they work with the sales team, what are the challenges we need to overcome, how can we better assist other parts of the business. And then with my team, looking at them and going, well, what are their strengths? What are the things that they, A, are good at, but will subsequently likely enjoy? And I would say if you're an IC, the things you're going to be best at are the things that you enjoy. And for me, the thing that I enjoy the most, even now in my role, is probably presenting to people. And I've had anecdotal feedback that I'm very good at presenting. And I know that's a strength of mine. There's things that I'm not, that I'm less strong at, and that I need to work on. And those tend to be the things that I enjoy less. Like coaching, for example, right? I want to have more time in coaching, but I know it's something I need to work on because I find it tricky right now, and I know that it's because I'm not as good at it as I could be. But that aha moment can be a number of things. I guess seeing my team succeed, absolutely, right? And it's not
And what does that success actually look like? Like, to be very specific, if you could give me an example, okay, or something very specific.
So the thing I would say, the thing that makes my day the most is more than when deals close. Deals closing, that's great, love that. That's the ultimate end goal. But when I get a message or an email or a call from someone else in the business, and let's say you were on my team, and it might be a VP of sales, and they call me up and say, Lydia absolutely crushed the demo today. Mm-hmm. There is no better feeling than that.
Right.
Because it's like that proud parent feeling. It's like, I'm not taking credit for you doing that, but I'm like, if you are able to go out and deliver to the best of your ability, that's because I have fulfilled my role because you've been enabled to do that.
And by the way, enabling doesn't mean just teaching, right?
No,
That was something that my previous manager, and I had a very close relationship with my previous manager. I think, I was very fortunate enough to have gotten that feedback from other people within VMware about me that was sent then to my manager. And I could see that he also got that, you know, he was the most happy when he would receive feedback like that about me, about other members of my team. But because of when he came in, I was already a full-fledged, like, there wasn't teaching to be done. I mean, mm-hmm. there's always coaching to be done, but mm-hmm. the brunt of the work was already done. From that point on, his, and I'm quoting here, like, his job was to clear the road in front of me. That being, like, yeah. if I needed assistance from marketing, if I needed, you know, materials, if I needed software, if I needed this, it's just about, again, and I want this to be very clear, and because I know this is, you know, is to give you more credit as a leader, because you're not just there enabling people in the traditional sense of teaching them. Mm-hmm. You were enabling them to have the runway mm-hmm. to do what needs to get done. Mm-hmm. And again, that be it by, it could involve many other functions of that, including like giving them time off when they need it, encouraging them to take a break, encouraging them to take a step back when they need it. And I think that's the most challenging part of that role. Again, from the individual contributor view, because I was very conscious of what my manager was doing at the time, which is exactly these things of like, oh, you were on the cusp of burnout. Go do something else, right? Mm-hmm. Go, you know, again, take some time off from, you know, you're doing, you know, your number is looking great. You don't need to be full, you know, pedal to the metal on this mm-hmm. side. Mm-hmm. How about go work on this project that you already have internally? Go talk to, you know, this person. You know, I'm sure they would use your skill sets for mm-hmm, something mm-hmm. different, just to change the perspective, you know, because sometimes we get so lost in the day-to-day that you do need that. And I think that is exactly the most valuable thing that a leader can do for their team. And I'm happy to hear, but I did notice something as you were describing the new aha moment, where it's no longer looking at the customer's eyes and like seeing the lights go on. It's now the result. So it's the feedback.
Yeah.
So that has shifted a little bit, because you can get the aha moment as an SE without getting the result. The deal might still not land. Mm. You might mm-hmm. still not mm-hmm. win the deal. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But you do get that satisfaction. But whilst it seems like as a leader now, it's far more focused on the final results.
It's on those, I would say it's the final result, but it's all the little things along the way. So it might be just being able to talk someone through a problem they're having. So they might be stuck on a deal. They might be like, I don't know how to progress. And I come in and I just help them. And it's not that I come in with this like fountain of knowledge, but I am a sounding board, and I talk it through with them, and they go, oh, actually that's really helpful. And all I have done in that moment is just be somebody who they feel safe and psychologically safe with to go, I feel vulnerable because I don't want to go to the sales director or my accounting exec and say, I don't know how we do this. I need to go to my manager, go to my leader. I need to ask his input on this. And again, it's not that I also like say it as I'm showing you how to get to where you can get to. You can get there. I just need to show you the way there. Mm-hmm. So let's come back to the kayaking analogy. I've done leadership as in literally like leading groups of people down a river. Now, I cannot get in the boat and paddle it for you. But what I can do is equip you with the skills and the knowledge and the experience and my experience of it to go, let's have a look at what's coming up. You're going to start here, you're going to end up here, and here's the flow that you've got to go through. And at that point, I say, do this, go this way, because if you go the other way, you're going to hit a rock, you're going to capsize, you know, and this is where you want to end up. And then the other thing I take away is that you don't have to lead from the front in those mm-hmm. situations. You can lead from the back. You can be, like, being a leader is, and I would say this to anyone who is an IC who is considering moving into leadership, you are not going to have your name up in lights as much as you do as an IC. Because when you get to the end of the quarter, the end of the year, the awards, company awards don't go out to best leaders. They might go to best teams, but they go to best individuals. And that's where they should go. And I'm not, I absolutely think that is, but it's a, you, it comes back to what we were saying about, you know, what's the function of being an SE and being in pre-sales, and you want to enable your customers to make their lives better. My role as a leader is to enable my team, as you say, through clearing roadblocks, through coaching them, through giving advice, through talking stuff, through to do their job better and to get that joy that I want them to at their job. And I love it. And it is hard and it is strange because you do have to disconnect from a lot of the technical stuff, which is quite hard to do initially. But the funnily enough, and I guess I'll end on this, when I was an IC and now as a leader, I always looked at what I did in the same way. And I'd like to know your thoughts actually on this as a business owner. I looked at what I did as my little business. Mm-hmm. So I looked at my, when I was an SE, I looked at my deals as being like, okay, this is my business. This is, my business runs on selling these, and this is the role I have to play in the business. And everybody else is playing a part of that, and they're the people I'm working with. They might be my team, they might be my colleagues, however you want to look at it. But I looked at it as my own little business, and what could I do personally to maximize the revenue for that business? So something's not working, what can I do differently? How do I bring more business in? How do I make things close faster? What can I do to make my business run better? I look now the same way as I look at my team, and I go, how do I look at what my team is delivering as a business and measure that against the goals? And obviously, my revenue goals are set by the company. But I want to look at, I don't just want to go, well, where are we on the regional or the company number? I want to look at the direct influence that my team is having on that. Where are we against our own numbers? And what could we do differently to do that better? And when you start to look at both your role in that way, and if you're a leader, looking at your team in that way, you definitely get to a different perspective and you can unlock quite a lot more creativity. But does that resonate with you as a business owner?
It does, and I'll be honest with you. I think one of the many reasons why it was the right decision and the logical decision for me to go independent was because I had the same mentality as an individual contributor that I have as a business owner. I took full ownership of everything I was doing, and I took the exact same approach that I do right now. My colleagues and the people that I work with, my account manager, was my customer in a very broad sense, in the sense of the way I position myself, the branding side of things, of thinking about branding, thinking about my own internal marketing. And I have a lot of this to thank, like, for my first manager within VMware, because he really glued me in on this idea that you are within this bigger behemoth of an organization, you are a person that needs to do your own marketing. You need to position yourself in a way that people would notice and care about the things you do for the sake of a promotion, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that was the only way, especially in a corporation where you have so many fantastic, talented individual contributors and leaders, how the heck do you stand apart that when time does come around for the limited amount of promotions they can do per year, your name is top of that.
Mm-hmm.
And the only way to do that is to consider yourself as a one-man band, as a one-man business, and consider how are you positioning what you do day in and day out. So, and also it really helps with then prioritizing different things, because it's a very common thing, you know, a very common complaint within the pre-sale space is that we don't have time. We don't have time for demo automation. We don't have time for enabling. We don't have time for this. You know, we're doing intro demos day in and day out. How do we even... That is where you start considering what is the highest valuable thing that you do as you as a business within an organization. Is it to focus... Like, you have your requirements. You have your contractual requirements that you need to do. Mm-hmm. Because, again, that's also how businesses work. You have a contract that you agree on, different tasks and responsibilities that you have for your customers, for them to actually give you money. And it's the same thing as when you were a full-time employee. That is what you have. You have a contract, which, as far as I understand and as far as I've seen so far, a lot of pre-sales is very vague. Like, you do have, you know, it's never really a, you know, oh, you need to do an intro demo at 9 a.m. every morning. Like, that's not a thing, right? You don't have that strict regimen of what you need to do. So your contract is quite vague, which is both the good and the bad thing. The good thing is that it can allow you that prioritization based on the requirements that you currently have, and how do you do that? And I think imagining yourself as a business really helps in that aspect, because it makes you be very conscious of where you spend your time and how you spend it the most effective, because that is all you have. And yes, you can hand over, or you can ask for help from different individuals within the organization, but again, funnily enough, I always consider that as a... And also, I was always very timid of asking for help from my teammates. It's because I always felt like I had a budget, quote-unquote, of help that I can have. And I needed to be very conscious. And because, and I say, when I say budget, is, you know, I use quotation marks in this case, because there wasn't really a budget, but there was a... It was a very complex sort of equation I had in my head around access to my customers. Do I want more people to be talking to my customers and sort of dissolve that personal relationship I have with them?
Mm-hmm.
You know, my own colleagues' time. And considering that if I ask them for help, obviously then I have to help them back. And is that something that I will be willing to, you know, at a drop of a hat, be able to do, because I feel like I owe them? And of course, I did owe them that help. And I still did it. You know, I still had to ask for help. And when anyone ever asked, I always jumped, you know, to go help them. But it was always that calculation around how do I run the operational side of things that I needed to do as an SE. So it really lend itself really easily into then becoming a business owner. And I would really encourage Tim listening, you know, if you are an individual contributor right now, try to frame it, even if you don't have an entrepreneurial bone in your body. Right, because I thought the same. I thought I would never be on my own. Even funnily enough, I recently spoke to a friend of mine who has been a business owner for like 20 odd years now, and like we used to be roommates. And I like she reminded me of a conversation that we had where I very proudly said, and this is like, you know, 6-7 years back, I very sort of like determinedly said, I will never have my own business. What you do is crazy. And here I am, right, 6 to 7 years down the line, doing exactly that. So whilst I say like it doesn't mean that you as an individual contributing SE right now need to consider like, ooh, you know, in 10 years time, I'll have to do like Lydia and go have my own business of whatever. That's not the case. But imagining yourself as a completely independent individual entity within the broader company that you work in is really helpful to understand, one, your purpose. Because then, again, what is the service that you provide to this company? And I would literally frame it like that. Like, what is the services? It is intro demos. That is a service you provide. It's a very low effort, but, you know, high time cost, because obviously you might do it day in, day out. So it's a commodity that you're offering. You are offering project work with internally to improve different elements of the company. That is a high effort thing, and also like huge amount of reward potentially. You need to do your own marketing, you need to do your own logistics, you need to do your own, a lot of these elements you need to consider in that way. And genuinely, I would say that has been the biggest factor in my success as an individual contributor. Having, you know, being able to be promoted so many times as I was, being able to get pay rises as I was, being able to be so upfront, you know, having direct access to the CEO, having direct access to our local CTO, and being part of Office of CTO, which was, you know, I always refer to it like the group of the biggest nerds, but it was a huge amount of work to get there, and the way to get there was through visibility. So that visibility is going to be really beneficial for you within that space. And I'm, again, just to be very, very clear, I do not, and you know, recommend or say that everyone needs to, you know, consider entrepreneurship as their final stage of their career. I don't think it's my final stage. You know, you never know. I might, you know, return back into, and a lot of people do this, where they, you know, go out being independent and return back to being in a bigger company, go off again, etc. Who knows, right? Like, you know, me 5 years down the line, I could be speaking a very different thing. But that mentality, I think, is incredibly beneficial for an individual contributor and a leader, as you know, you were describing now. Your team is your company. You know, you're part of this bigger thing. But you know, what is the services? What is the position that your team has within this bigger space?
No notes. On that.
Nailed it.
If only, I just think, and I'm just going, yeah, if only to say, I would say, I suppose, two, maybe three things to just, an addendum to those. I would say your goal does not have to be purely financial or developmental, by which I mean, you do not have to set your business goal being, I want to get a promotion, I want to get a pay rise. It could be, I want to move into this role. It could be, I want to be able to go down to 4 days a week so I can do something else with my time. But set a goal, right? What is your business? What is, for this year, or the rest of this year, what is the goal for your business in the company? The second thing is, look at your kind of life outside work. And I think SEs are naturally quite entrepreneurially minded because of that creativity, because of the need to prioritize, because of the need to actually take back control of your time, which can be really hard. But I promise you, if you do it for just a couple of weeks, people will start to respect that. That, you know, don't have to accept every meeting. Ask for agendas. Ask what is the purpose? Because you're not going to drive that change. You cannot drive that change top down. It's very hard to drive top down change in an organization, particularly as an IC, even as a leader, right? There are so many layers that you have to go through to get change implemented. But what you can do is you can change how you operate. And if people see what you're doing and like what you're doing, then they will follow that. But look at not just how you operate in your day-to-day, but look at how you operate in your life around work. Look at that as a business as well. And what I mean by that is, think about where you spend your time. Think about what is important to you every year. Where do you want to be in a year, 2 years, 5 years from now as an individual? And use that to drive where you spend your time. Because the hardest thing, and you know, talk about this, what is the purpose of being an SE? The purpose of being an SE, to take your thing of making complicated things easy to understand, I would say to help people make the right decision for them, their business, and their career. You know, adopt that mindset to how you function in life, and you will just start to see huge changes. And the final thing that I would say to do that is create a personal board of directors, both within the company and externally. So, Lydia, you've helped me a lot, right, with reaching out to people for mentorship, and you basically said, just do it, because people will do it, and I did it, and people did it, and, you know, in the last couple of months, I have been absolutely blown away by the generosity, particularly of the pre-sales community, and people's willingness to just give you 30 minutes of their time. Right, just ask, they'll give it to you. And I'm talking like senior leaders in organizations of 20,000-30,000, leading hundreds or thousands of SEs. They will give you 30 minutes if you ask for it, because it's not a bit, you know, be precise about what you ask, but they'll give you that time and go in with that expectation of, okay, this is a person who can help me make a decision. Because the board of directors is, yeah, they want the business to be successful, but they're also there to advise. They're also there to say, this is what I saw in this company that I was doing before, so this is why you should do it this way. But have that, and it's having that internally as well, and that can be, I would say, not your manager, right? This is not about, you know, have other people, and that might be peers, that might be other leaders in the business. But I know from personal experience that sort of internal branding and marketing that I've done has meant that when very senior leadership has changed in the business, without me really engaging with them, they already know who I am. And I'm going into a conversation with them one-to-one and they're going, you're thought of very highly in this company. And I'm just like, okay. So that, but you probably don't realize actually quite often the level of recognition that you can get from doing those things.
The goal is for people to speak highly about you when you are not there. And I think that's it's very vague in the sense because like, how do I do that? And I think the most actionable and practical way to think about that is exactly to think about it yourself as a business. Like you, as a business, you want good reviews, right? You want people to give you like 5 stars that you've done a great job with them. And they give you like some sort of review, a couple of sentences saying like, yeah, this is great. That is the intention that you should have whenever you're working with folks, both internally and externally within a field that you want to be in. Not in the sense of, you know, and don't feel sleazy about that. I think that's also something that's very important for people not to think that they're doing something that is not okay or it is very salesy. Because it might, like, especially the way I described it right now, it might feel a little salesy of like, you know, oh, I'm in it for the review. Not really. It's just to be conscious that your goal in this interaction, in this, you know, whatever it is, you know, you're asking or helping with or project you're a part of or deal you're a part of, the goal is for both customer, prospect, colleague, etc., to leave with the idea that, hey, working with Paul is actually really great. Right, because of this and this reason. And especially if you're in control and aware of what this and this has to be, you're timely, you go above and beyond, you're always thinking outside of the box. If you go in the conversation with that intention, more often than not, you will find that you're able to achieve that naturally because you have already set up that intention. I think a lot of us tend to go into conversations situations and projects, you know, and deal conversations as well, without really setting an intention. It's just like, oh, I just walked in and I'm just going to do something, right? Which is, again, it's completely normal, especially if you're early on in your career or just haven't had the chance to listen to someone talk it through or haven't had the coaching and the guidance on that. But I think really that intentional piece is really important because it guides, you know, it comes from that goal that you're setting for yourself, life goal, work goal, and then you have the practicals, which is coming into this conversation with the intention that everyone is going to leave thinking, man, what a fantastic time I had with this person because of this and this reason. By the way, practical example for me is I always walked into a conversation with, if there is a problem, and most of the time I was brought in because there is a problem that needed to be solved. Either, again, a customer didn't understand the value of the product. There was a miscommunication about like what are the requirements versus what is the actual, you know, whatever the situation was. My intention, every conversation was to walk in and be Lydia who solves the problem, right? I wanted to be a problem solver. And at the end, that was the feedback and the reviews I was getting from folks as I was collecting them for that application for the CTO office. That was the feedback I got. That when Lydia came in, problems got solved. And by the way, that doesn't mean that I always had a solution to the problem. My intention, though, was for that problem to be solved. And it didn't have to be in that one call. So please don't put that pressure on yourselves if that is, you know, what you want you to be. Because I didn't feel that pressure on myself. Because again, my intention was not to solve the problem. My intention was to be there to try my best to solve the problem. And again, it could have been ended in that one conversation. Or it could have meant that, oh, I now understand what the problem is better. Thank you, Mr. Customer. I will take this away now and go and talk to product management, you know, leadership, whatever I needed to do to move this problem, you know, forward to try to resolve it. And then again, what are the other things I did? I kept people involved and, checking in. Like, hey, we spoke yesterday about this one problem. Just a reminder, this is what I perceived this problem was. This is the steps that we agreed on the call that I would take. And this is how far I've gotten with this, right? I spoke to product management. I'm waiting for them to come back to me. I will chase them up in a couple of days if they don't come back because I know they're busy. And then I'll come back to you with a solution, right? That was what I wanted to do. And that was exactly the direct feedback I got. So consider how you want people to describe you behind closed doors when you're not in that conversation. And be very specific, right? Be very as specific as you can be. I want to be a problem solver. I want to clarify whatever, you know, I want to come in and for people to leave knowing exactly what's happening in the situation. I want people to feel good about talking to me, right? I want them to be felt that they're positive. You know, you're coming into a very like adversarial conversation, especially when there's something, you know, with customer services or, supports or I always found that with, you know, and it's no fault to our professional services colleagues, but usually things start breaking down post the sales process. Because obviously, you know, unfortunately, unintentionally, we tend to promise quite a lot. And then sometimes reality doesn't stick. We try to avoid it. That's part of the pre-sales role, you know. But we don't have full control of that environment. So sometimes there are problems, especially in post-sale services. So your intention could be as a remediator, right? I'm coming in. People are angsty. People are you know, there's a lot of negative emotions. I'm going to come in and make sure everyone is friendly again. Everyone is good, right? Whatever that intention is going to be for you, pick and choose and work towards that. And I promise you, when you should always ask for feedback, better written, from your colleagues, from your peers, from your leadership team, from your customers. If you get something in writing, you will see that highlighted in that feedback.
I'll just end that, maybe facetiously, on a quote. The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
AI
therapy.
Let me, hold on, where's my pen?
Slightly different intro.
Yep, there you go. So picking up.
I'm gonna lie down like this.
Yeah, lie down for a bit.
I cannot hold this position.
Sorry,
this
Paul.
Is talking about a workout. So, Lydia, if I was to tell you that there was a great new feature that was going to come to Windows computers, which would mean that, you know, we always get that time when you think, oh, what was that document that I was working on or that website I was looking at that was really useful, but I can't remember it. Wouldn't it be great if you could ask an AI assistant to tell you what that was? It'd be super helpful.
Yeah, right? Incredibly so.
That was what Microsoft were going to introduce on their Copilot Plus PCs. So Copilot being their AI embedded agent in Windows, that built on ChatGPT, but it was going to run locally. And this feature was called Recall. And Recall worked by essentially taking screenshots every second of what you were doing and storing them on your computer. Storing them locally. Okay, so yeah, far, yeah.
That's fine.
Storing them in plain text. Locally. But in plain text.
That's fine.
But everything locally. In plain text. Yeah, it's been recalled. Recall's been recalled. Well, actually, it hasn't been recalled. They just haven't put it out yet.
That is, you can't write this joke.
You can't make this up.
As someone with a security background, the idea of things like, I was being a little bit facetious there with like, yeah, what's the problem? It's local. Because I am pretty sure that was exactly the positioning that Microsoft took. I was like, yeah, what's the problem? It's local. So there is a lot of systems in place and in machines, you know, to secure things like passwords, like, you know, how to, you know, and you can always make the argument that, yeah, when you input your password, more often than not, they're hidden behind the, you know. But I know for myself, like, you know, sometimes I open up LastPass and I actually look at my passwords because then I have to type them out by hand. So that means that suddenly my passwords are not stored in a vault in LastPass. They're now stored in a file somewhere on my Windows machine. And more importantly, I think, but to be honest with you, my biggest problem with this whole story is that Microsoft will release PC specifically built from Microsoft. So this feature is not coming to other PCs, which is their whole spiel that they can run on any machine. What about Lenovo? What about like custom built gaming PCs like the one I have, right? So are you, Microsoft, are you trying to be Apple and have phone ownership of both the physical and the software side of things? Is that what you're doing?
Yeah.
I think it's really hard to pull the plug on something that you've, like, again, the power of Microsoft. The reason I am running, like, you know, Windows on my gaming PC is exactly because it runs.
Mm.
And then suddenly you're starting to introduce features that are specific for one machine that you produce. Again, this is exactly what Apple does, but Apple has been doing it from the get-go. You can't have your cake and eat it too, right? Because as far as I understand, and just again, logicking my way through this, you cannot have this feature run on all Windows machines.
No.
Because you need to make sure that obviously they have enough GPU, they have enough CPU, they have enough, you know, disk space, they have everything needed to for that model to actually run locally.
It's so, specifically, yeah, it's specifically Windows on ARM.
Right.
On ARM processors.
Right.
And it's the specific Windows computers that have a Copilot button on the keyboard.
Yeah, obviously, because it's the button that makes the magic, not the...
Yeah, yeah, of course.
Not the, like, hardware.
A new button. It's a new button. Yeah. What can I do? I mean, I just was like, well, I can't...
I'm pretty sure you can Amazon that button.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. Get a sticker.
Yeah.
I have a Copilot button.
No, so, yeah, there's a lot of things in there when it's an open system like that, and especially when you consider, again, looking at it from a security perspective, plain text, local file stored for your average Joe, right? For me, for example, sitting on my gaming PC and, you know, doing my, you know, that would be really useful. Am I going to be super concerned about the security risks of that? You know, unless there's always a chance. Right, because especially when you install like random bits and pieces on your PC, like, you never, unless you're really security conscious, you don't really know what has access to your local file system. So that's a risk,
right,
among many others. But then you have Windows as the most common corporate operating system. Thus, is the one that most people will do their best to try to hack into, because again, you get into one, you get into them all. A lot of governments, healthcare uses Windows.
There is
no world where having plain text openly available, even if it's locally stored, even if it's locally processed, there is no world where Microsoft Defender, which is fine, by the way, for your day-to-day usage. By the way, please don't install, like, you know, this is a security PSA. Do not install any additional security products on your Windows computers. You don't need them. You don't need McAfee. You don't need anything like that. Please, please, please don't. Windows Defender is more than enough for your day-to-day usage. If your organization uses something else, that's on an organizational level, and that is completely else. But on a per desktop, you're just using something at home. You don't need anything else, but, you know, Windows Defender. And please also enable it. It's just good practice. Unless, obviously, you download something sketchy from a Russian, you know, torrent site, and it tells you that, oh, this is obviously something malicious. You can turn it off for that. That's fine. please don't sue me. But caveat: I'm not a professional security person. Please don't sue me if something looks wrong. anymore. Right.
Anymore.
Yeah, I think it's quite funny that they're doing this.
It is funny.
Are they recalling the feature itself, or are they
the feature itself? So they've completely the machines are still shipping, but it's now just a web app. So the intent was these were going to be Copilot AI enabled machines to kind of do some of the actually useful things that we've talked about, like being able to go and change the settings and have actual kind of like assistant functionality.
So then what's the selling point for those machines now? Right, that's it, that's gone.
That's it, what is the selling point?
Right.
It just feels, again, and I don't want to kind of bang this drum again, but I will. There was after we recorded last time, reacting to WWDC and Apple Intelligence, and we even noted that, yes, Samsung has had this for years, but it's when stuff like this happens that you go, yeah, that just, in an Apple world, that is not gonna, they're not gonna ship a feature that fundamentally doesn't, or trailer feature, and go, this specific machine or device is gonna have this feature, and then not have it work. They will do their utmost to hide the fact that the Vision Pro only lasts 2 hours and had a cable down the back to the battery pack, but they won't claim that it runs for 12 hours and then ship a version that runs for 2.
Yeah.
It's just this, but I do think it is symptomatic of the fact that Microsoft don't want to get left behind. They see this as a platform shift, like when we went from, you know, desktops to laptops to phones. Like AI enabled, machine learning enabled technology is the future, and I think I'm feeling slightly vindicated that the tangible use cases we're now seeing for this technology is in just doing all the boring stuff, is not in like transformational changing the way you work, but actually just making life a little bit easier. But they don't want to miss it.
I'm shocked that Microsoft are trying to do it on a platform level when they have such an iron grip on corporate. Do more with Teams. Do more with Outlook. I will jump ship to Outlook. If that Microsoft ecosystem becomes fully AI powered, aka exactly what we were talking that, you know, Apple were doing or will be doing at some point in the future when they do release it, which is again like a really funny thing of like, yeah, you know, there will be features and, you know, introduced at some point in the future. Maybe next year, maybe the year after, we'll see. But if right now Microsoft say like, hey, you know, integrating Outlook, Teams, everything else all together, you will have a Office Assistant, right? Mm-hmm. Call it Office Assistant even. Microsoft, I'm giving you a freebie here. Call it Office Assistant, and it's a chatbot that I can, like with, you know, all of the voice assistants, I can tell it like, hey, you have full visibility of my workday, everything that has to do with my job. One, do all the boring stuff for me, like making an agenda for a meeting that I'm having based on the previous conversations we've been having over Teams, over email, etc., etc. Do all that stuff for me. Shuffle around events for me. Do this for me, right? Exactly the same thing that I would expect from, you know, Apple side of things in a couple of years' time. Do it today in Microsoft land, and guess what? I will shuffle again into Microsoft. You know, give them a, you know, a big chunk of change and go like, yep. Well, welcome to Office 365 world. I want it to be 365. I want it to be my whole work world. And I want there to be a UI slash, you know, AI assistant, whatever, that I can use right now. You know what I don't want? I don't want to have to buy a Microsoft branded laptop with a specific chipset that can potentially, and not even anymore, do something that's quite dodgy, right? You don't need to take all of my data. Take the data I've already given you in all of my work stuff. You don't need to track everything. You don't need to track every move I make and every breath I take. That's fine. We don't need to go that far. Just do the boring stuff right now. And that's again, I think you've nailed that over there, because like with the boring stuff, nobody has yet nailed the boring stuff.
Nope.
Do the boring stuff for me. Stop writing stuff for me. Stop drawing things for me. I don't want it. I want you to write emails for me.
Yep.
That's it.
Yep.
And like, actually organize my emails based on tags or whatever that you consider is important, or I tell you it's important to me. Mm-hmm. Like, I didn't tell you this, but I announced email bankruptcy on my personal Gmail recently because I had like 1,000 emails that I hadn't responded to, and I just took everything and archived it because I just couldn't. You know what would have been great? If I could just ask an AI ML algorithm just to tell me, like, is there anything important? Can you just give me a summary of these 1,000 emails? And is there anything important in here? And just, and then learn from this subset what's important to me, because I'll tell you yes, no, yes, no. And then set some filters for me. That would be great. Why don't we do that?
Yeah. Yeah.
This AI therapy corner became Lydia's ranting about AI
it
corner.
Did.
I'm sorry.
It's all good. It's all good.
So how are you feeling about that, Paul?
I feel so much better.
You feel so much better?
Yeah.
You feel better that Microsoft have gone like, oopsies.
Yes.
Maybe we shouldn't do that.
Maybe we shouldn't.
Not yet. The fact that they're shipping the machines to me indicates that they will still try to push this at some point or another. Just not yet. But I will be very curious to see the sales numbers on that. Because again, there is no selling feature at this point. What is the selling feature?
Right.
They need some pre-sales.
They need some pre-sales.
They need some pre-sales in their lives to teach them how to actually sell to people.
They do.
Microsoft called me.